TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness.
The fossil fuel companies, given their record to date, are far more effective at capturing politicians than they are at capturing emissions. And they have captured control of the political and policymaking process in too many countries and too many regional governments. And they've reached out to try to capture the UN process.
Al Gore on Big Oil, COP28, and the fight for climate action. This year's United Nations Climate Summit will be the biggest in history and the first held in a major petrostate, which is ironic, since according to Al Gore, phasing out fossil fuels is our most urgent task. Al Gore, the former U.S. vice president, tells Simon Mundy in a Financial Times interview why he thinks this year's COP28 climate change talks are likely to fail. The interview was published on October 24, 2023.
For COP28, are you holding out any hope for the event? I mean, you make a powerful case for the idea that it's a fatally flawed event, given who's hosting it and who's acting as the president.
I think the deck is stacked against a successful outcome. I will, along with many others, continue to work for as much progress as we can get. A successful COP outcome would commit the world to phasing out fossil fuels in line with the latest science so we can meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. Of course, agreement on phasing out fossil fuels would, at this point, be a victory. The industry is against it. The petrostates are against it. One of theirs has the gavel and is in charge of what happens. But phasing out fossil fuels, even if we can get that, is really only the bare minimum. This is something that we should have agreed to decades ago. The climate crisis is a fossil fuel crisis. In contrast, language that just says we should eventually decrease our fossil fuel consumption and slowly phase down fossil fuels, that's woefully insufficient. We have a global emergency. Just look at the incredible catastrophes unfolding all over the world. Canada has been on fire. The storms are getting much more intense. The United Kingdom has another rain bomb alert today. We saw a third of Pakistan underwater, the worst drought in all of human recorded history in China last year, with temperatures reaching extremely dangerous levels, the ice melting accelerating, sea level rising, tropical diseases spreading, and the mobilization of climate refugees crossing international borders in numbers that have already triggered xenophobia, with the prediction from the Lancet Commission that 1 billion climate refugees could be moving across borders in this century if we continue to expand the areas that are physiologically uninhabitable for human beings, triggering a threat to our capacity for self-governance. We have the solutions in our hands. We need to remove the political obstacles and opposition being put in place by the fossil fuel companies. They've used their legacy network of financial and political ties and lobbying and campaign contributions and the revolving door and the demand for continued government subsidies for the destruction of humanity's future. When are we going to wake up? The good news is people around the world are waking up, and they're recognizing, with the appointment of this COP presidency, it reveals the practice that's been underway for quite some time. By the time of the Glasgow COP, fossil fuel companies already had a number of delegates than the largest national delegation. And by last year in Egypt at COP27, the fossil fuel participants were more than those of the 10 most climate-affected countries all combined. And now they are formally in charge. It takes off the disguise. It reveals the reality that we've been wrestling with for quite some time. We need to change the rules so that one petrostate or one fossil fuel company can't stand up and say, no, I won't permit that. You need unanimity. So I won't agree to it because I want to continue racing greedily for more and more profits while we continue filling the sky. This image behind me, Simon, is a picture from the space station of how thin the troposphere. The blue is where the oxygen refracts the light. You could walk to the top of that blue line in an hour if you walked fast. That's what we're using it as an open sewer. And the accumulated amount is now trapping as much extra heat as would be released by 750,000 Hiroshima-class atomic bombs exploding on the Earth every 24 hours. That's why the oceans are getting so hot and putting all that water vapor into the sky. That's why the droughts are hitting more quickly. That's why the storms are getting stronger. That's why the ice is melting. That's why salt water is coming into the aquifers in coastal areas. That's why agriculture is threatened. That's why the IPCC has said we could face a global food crisis with a multi-breadbasket failure if we continue this reckless assault on the ecological systems that undergird the possibility for humanity to flourish. We have developed the alternatives. We have the policies that work. We need to get the political resistance out of the way. And when Sultan Al-Jaber says the fossil fuel companies should collaborate with policymakers to advance progress, not impede progress, who's he kidding? Do they take us for fools? Don't they realize we can see with our own eyes and hear with our own ears that they are impeding progress? They see their job as to prevent the implementation of any policies that would reduce the production and consumption of oil by a single barrel, by gas by a single cubic foot, the coal by a single ton. They want to continue burning more and more and more, and it is a threat to our children and our grandchildren and to the present generation. We have to demand progress and get these lobbyists and companies and politicians that are in their pocket out of the way so that the will of the people around the world who want to save the future, who want to give people an opportunity to hope for a brighter future. If we get to true net zero, if we stop any net additions, the temperatures will stop going up in the world almost immediately, a lag time of as little as 3 to 5 years. If we stay at true net zero, half of all the human-caused greenhouse gas pollution will have fallen out of the atmosphere in as little as 25 to 30 years. We can start the healing process. It'll take time, but we can halt the temperature increase and start turning in the right direction if we can find the political will to overcome this greedy, immoral opposition from the fossil fuel companies who are making so much money from continuing the destruction of humanity's future. But the good news is political will is itself a renewable resource, and we are seeing it renewed in countries all over the world, particularly by young people.
But on that question of political will, I mean, as you say, there are reasons for optimism, for example, from the younger generation of politically active people. And yet, in my country, the UK, as you know, we've seen a rollback of momentum from the Prime Minister. It seems to me that it's not just the UK and other European countries. We're seeing similar pressure around climate commitments as some of these commitments start to really become actionable. In the US, as you say, transformational legislation in the form of the Inflation Reduction Act last year, but who knows what's going to happen next year with the presidential election, and it's possible that momentum could go into reverse in this country as well. How do you feel about leaving aside the political activists, but in terms of the people who are actually running the governments of the world at the moment, is that political will there?
Well, we see signs of it, and the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act was a historic achievement. And then we saw the change in government in Australia and in Brazil, and the continued commitment, for the most part, of the European Union. We are seeing some signs of legitimate progress, but we have to deal with the deception and the falsehoods of the large polluters. For example, in your recent interview with the head of the Abu Dhabi company who heads the COP, he said his company has decarbonized. What? Again, do you take us for fools? Well, what he means is that they're using some more renewable power for their internal operations, ignoring the 80% of the pollution that is not covered at all. That would be like a tobacco company saying that they're tobacco-free because they banned the smoking of cigarettes inside their office buildings by their employees. continuing to kill millions and millions of people with the product that's out there. That's the same exact thing. And they're trying to pull the wool over our eyes and make us believe that they're going to take responsibility for solving this. Well, they're incentivized to go in the opposite direction, but we have a right to demand that they stop blocking and fighting against the efforts of others to solve this crisis. We are now seeing in my country the building of all of these solar and wind and EV and battery facilities in some of the so-called red states, the conservative states. There is a political constituency being built up for the energy transition, Simon, and that is a positive development. We have the direction of travel. The majority of companies outside of the fossil fuel sector are moving, for the most part, in a very determined way. And we're seeing the adoption of clean energy, not only in the U.S., India last year, the most populous country in the world. People are surprised when they hear that of all the new electricity generation installed in India last year, 93% was solar and wind. We are seeing progress, but we have got to clear these obstacles out of the way, and we have got to reform the system for allocating capital globally so that the developing countries are not walled off from access to borrowing the money and capitalizing this green energy revolution.
That was former Vice President Al Gore in a Financial Times interview with Simon Mundy. It was published under the title Al Gore on Big Oil, COP28, and the Fight for Climate Action. Find it and watch it on the YouTube channel of the Financial Times. About a month before this conversation, at the end of September 2023, the New York Times invited Al Gore to their Climate Forward event to discuss what's standing in the way of progress in solving the global climate challenges. Here's David Gallus of the New York Times.
For my next guest, who I think is waiting in the wings, I'm excited to welcome the former Vice President of the United States, the man who brought us An Inconvenient Truth 16 years ago, Vice President Al Gore. Hi, Mr. Vice President.
Good to see you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure and honor. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You can imagine I want to talk politics in just a few minutes.
Yeah.
First, though, I want to talk about what I have sensed is a change in your own tone in talking about these issues in the last couple of years. You're being somewhat measured right now compared to some of the remarks I've seen you make in recent years and even some of the interviews we've done over the summer. But if I may, it seemed like for a while you were sort of trying to hold people's hands. And now sometimes it seems like you're shouting from the rooftop about this. And I wonder, how do you think about that change in tone? The TED Talk you gave, where you were really going after individuals, fossil fuel companies, and speaking about this with a different level of urgency. What accounts for that change in your own communication?
Well, for me, one thing is that I think they went too far in naming the CEO of one of the largest and by many measures, one of the dirtiest oil companies on the planet as the president of the UN conference on climate this year. That's just like taking the disguise off. They've been trying to capture this process for a long time. The fossil fuel companies, given their record to date, are far more effective at capturing politicians than they are at capturing emissions. And they have captured control of the political and policymaking process in too many countries and too many regional governments, and they've reached out to try to capture the UN process. Last year at Sharm el-Sheikh at the last COP, the fossil fuel delegates outnumbered the delegations of the 10 most climate-impacted nations all put together. It's really absurd. And to connect that to a larger trend, I was one of many who felt for a long time that the fossil fuel companies, or at least many of them, were sincere in saying that they wanted to be a meaningful part of bringing solutions to this crisis. But I think that it's now clear they are not. Mm. Fossil fuel industry speak with forked tongue. They have portrayed themselves as the source of trusted advice that we need to solve this crisis. But they are responding to powerful incentives to keep digging and drilling and pumping up the fossilized remains of dead animals and plants and burning them in ways that use the atmosphere as an open sewer, threatening the future of humanity. And it's enough already. Last year, if you look at their overall revenue and profits and stock buybacks, how much did they spend on this energy transition? 1%, 1%. It is a ruse. It is a ruse. And many of the largest companies have engaged in massive fraud for some decades now. I mean, it's really true. They followed the playbook of the tobacco industry in actively using these very sophisticated, lavishly financed strategies for deceiving people. So, look, I don't think it's fair to expect them to solve this when they're incentivized to do otherwise. But I think it's more than fair to ask them to get out of the way and stop blocking the efforts of everybody else to solve this crisis. Yeah. And so I think it's time to call them out on that.
There's some of that fire and brimstone I've seen lately. Let me ask, though. It sounds like you're in direct contradiction to what my previous guest, Mayor Bloomberg, just said. He said these companies, big oil, is a part of the solution. Now, with things like carbon capture, which is a technology that many people say is going to be essential, whether we like it or not, for many decades and even potentially a century to come, the fossil fuel companies say that they are best positioned to develop that technology. You, however, are coming out and really raising some sharp questions about the viability and the motivations of those pursuing carbon capture. And I wonder, you're familiar enough with science to understand that there's real logic to the notion that it may well be needed as we try to get towards net zero. How do you think about, again, that tension between trying to criticize the companies that you say are sort of slow walking this transition while not impeding the ability to develop the technologies we actually need?
Yeah, okay, well, let's be precise on this. I support research on carbon capture and sequestration. I even support research on this direct air capture technology, which is in its present state kind of absurd. But let's research what it might be possible. But there's a big difference between exploring an infant technology to see if it can be developed and telling the public, oh, we can do this right now, and therefore we can continue burning fossil fuels forever. The CEO of one of the largest oil companies in the world, based here in the United States, said direct air capture gives us a license to continue operating. This means that we don't ever have to stop oil. Well, you know, the phrase moral hazard refers to a proposal that has the disadvantage of fooling people into thinking they don't have to act. For them, the moral hazard is not a bug, but a feature. They have tried actively to create the false impression that there's no problem continuing to burn fossil fuels and even increase the rate of burning. It's similar to what the tobacco companies did. They, after the Surgeon General's report famously linked smoking cigarettes to deadly diseases, they hired actors and dressed them up as doctors, put them in front of cameras to say, there's absolutely no health problem whatsoever involved with smoking cigarettes. And 100 million people died before the truth got its boots on. And caught up with them, and we're still dealing with it. They chose some of the same PR professionals. They lifted that blueprint from the tobacco industry playbook. And look, there was a time when some of the leaders of these companies seemed credible in saying they're going to help lead the transition. Look what happened last year. They started rolling back their commitments and investments to renewables and doubling down on more and more fossil fuel production and exploration.
And it's not just the fossil fuel companies themselves that are rolling back some of their targets. Just recently, the United Kingdom. started rolling back some of its commitments. The UK has been a leader in clean energy. Yeah. You just came out and criticized Prime Minister Rishi Sunak for this rollback of some of their targets. What does it say to you about the geopolitical and economic realities of this energy transition that even a clean energy leader like the UK is rolling back some of its targets at this moment?
Well, even members of his own Conservative Party in the UK, many of them criticized his shocking decision yesterday. I'm not a citizen of the UK, and this is for the people of the UK to deal with, but one of his predecessors and many of the young Tories in the UK were just devastated by that decision. As someone wrote recently, Mother Nature is staging an intervention. This past summer has made it obvious to most everyone that this crisis has reached a new level of seriousness. Look at Libya. I don't want to pick out specific examples. When I started giving my slideshow, I used to illustrate all the different climate-related catastrophes with images or stories from, this was 10 years ago, this was 8 years ago, this was in the 80s. Now I say this was yesterday, this was the day before yesterday, this is going on right now. And it is getting the attention of people worldwide. Yeah. Even those who don't want to use the phrase climate crisis are finding their own ways of saying we got to do something about this.
Yeah, yeah. You've known this, though, and many scientists have known that this very moment was coming for decades now.
You know, this is the most difficult thing that humanity has ever tried to accomplish. We get 80% of all the energy in the global economy from fossil fuels still. So it's not going to be easy. But we do have this remarkable development of alternatives. And they're good for us in practically every way. You know, last year, 88% of all the new electricity generation worldwide was from renewables. 20% of all the new vehicle sales. And we know from past technological revolutions that that's a threshold beyond which the trend takes off even faster at a steeper angle of ascent. We're seeing now the emergence of regenerative agriculture and sustainable forestry, circular models and green hydrogen, green steel. It will take time. But what I've been concentrating on of late is how can we remove the obstacles to speeding up this progress? And one of the obstacles is, honestly, the continuing deception and political combat by the fossil fuel companies. And you know, they're hardly unique. I mean, we can't pass rational gun legislation in the U.S. because the gun manufacturers have found a way to capture the political process. And you could give other examples. But the stakes are so high on this, we have to find a way to remove their opposition and call them out. The second obstacle is we have to change the allocation of global private capital around the world so that developing countries can participate in this sustainability revolution by gaining access to the private capital that's essential. 86% of all the money that was used to build out solar and wind and EVs is from the private capital markets. And as long as some of these developing countries like Nigeria is effectively prohibited from accessing these markets, that drives them toward the financing that's freely available to them to build more fossil fuel infrastructure. There are more fossil pipelines under construction in Africa today than in North America. So we have to turn this ocean liner, sorry to mix metaphors, but we have to remove these obstacles so that the progress can speed up. I think that in order to solve the climate crisis, we do have to spend time on addressing the democracy crisis, because our processes of self-government have been sabotaged by the introduction of vast amounts of special interest money in ways that are far more toxic than in the past. The Supreme Court decisions that allow secret dark money donations to politicians and to PACs without any record of where it's coming from and who's paying for it. This has enabled some of the special interests motivated by pure greed to be able to distort the political process in America and enact their will even when the vast majority of the American people disagree with what they're doing to the policies. And we have to address this problem of policy capture. Now, it can seem like a very daunting task, and it is, but we have to do it. We have to find a way to do it. Now, here's what is most needed, and that is a much larger uprising at the grassroots level, like the one here in this city last weekend, where a shocking, far more people than were expected, 75,000 people in the streets of Manhattan, and in hundreds of countries around the world, you're seeing this same thing. Not just the young people, but others. This is a moment for people power. And when I said a moment ago, the frontline activists are the ones who inspire me, they are the source of our hope on this. People who are waking up and realizing that the future for their children and grandchildren is really and truly at stake here. We heard in the last panel, Reverend Yearwood talked about sacrifice zones in Cancer Alley. They're trying to make this a sacrifice planet, you know. We're using the sky as an open sewer. We're trapping as much extra heat every day with this pollution as would be released by 600,000 Hiroshima-class atomic bombs. That's disrupting the water cycle and creating all these catastrophes. And we don't have much time left to wake up and start taking action. I wish, David, that I was eloquent enough to find the words to transfer from my heart and the hearts of these activists to others everywhere in this country and the world, the sense of urgency that's appropriate for this. And it ought to be seen as a privilege to be alive at a time when those of us on this planet in this decade have an opportunity to do truly historic things to save the future of human civilization. That is what it's at risk. We have to get busy about this work.
Mm. Thank you for that.
That was a standing ovation for former Vice President Al Gore on stage in the series of New York Times events and published on September 21st, 2023 on YouTube. You can watch the full 33-minute conversation under the title, What's Standing in the Way of Climate Progress? You heard excerpts from two interviews with Al Gore in preparation of COP28. The 28th United Nations Climate Conference will be held from November 30 until December 12, 2023 at the Expo City, Dubai. And Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber has been nominated to preside. He's the Managing Director and Group CEO of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, ADNOC. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.